Hi, this is Dr. Jonathan Douglas, and you're listening to On Psych, the podcast of the Ontario Psychological Association. I'm a psychologist in Barrie, Ontario, and I am here today with Dr. Tyler Black, who is a psychiatrist specializing in suicidology. So welcome, and thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
Yeah. You are someone I've been familiar. We've never spoken before, but I've known you for, it feels like years, because of our Twitter accounts.
Yes, that is true.
And I'm familiar with your voice because I also follow the House of Pod, right? So you're frequently a guest there. I think you're one of Kaveh's favorite guests on that one. You and Ryan Marino.
Everybody's one of Kaveh's favorite guests.
That's true. Yes. So thank you for joining me on my much less professional one. And being less professional than Kaveh's, that's an achievement. I'm proud of that.
No shade.
So the reason I have invited you here today is because I have bookmarked a number of your threads that I love to deploy in, of course, the incredibly challenging task of attempting to use data to convince people they're wrong. Always know it's just, there's no point in doing this, but here it goes again.
You know, it's funny. I often say I've been doing this since before there was an internet, because, you know, back in the days before the World Wide Web, there was Usenet servers and things like this where people would share information. And, you know, there's always been a rich and robust skeptical sort of debunking community.
Yes.
But it's incredible how nothing is new under sun, because even though all the platforms have changed, all the, you know, the ways in which people get information have changed, the core disinformation arguments, the core things, like who'd have thunk that in 2023 we'd be have a huge rise of anti-vaxxerism, or I guess 2024 now. It is really incredible how nothing is new in this data war.
It really is. Although I think there are some surprises in that the anti-vax movement used to be a left-wing thing.
Yeah.
Right? So that used to be like, you know, the hippies and the gorilla crunchers, they were the ones who would be, we got to be all natural, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, the chiropractic and this kind of a thing, you know, the all natural medicine movement was much more associated with the left. And something has flipped, which I find absolutely fascinating in that.
I don't think it's accidental. I think, you know, because there's always been a strong grifting component to these sort of, less medically rigorous treatments and positions, the market was in the distrust of the government. The market was in the distrust of the authority. The market was in all these people that are upset at doctors and scientists and politicians and all this. And so the pull to the right was, in some ways, when you look back at it, a little bit inevitable, because of course, your average person who's selling a treatment that is no better than placebo is really interested in selling the treatment more than they are in helping people. And of course, where the market is largest is not in the granola crunching, you know, hippies who don't spend on anything. It's in this fast right wing group. It's been quite a thing to see the grifting. Yeah.
Follow the money, right?
Yeah.
That often explains it. But one of the two threads that stands out for me, you know, and you know being so familiar with this, you are of course aware of just how much suicide has dramatically increased over the course of the pandemic, which of course is an obvious fact that everybody knows, correct?
Well, this is the thing, is I've been battling myths about suicide for my whole career. You know, I took on suicidology even early as a resident in psychiatry, because I had experienced a patient suicide and my teachers were teaching me opposite things. One teacher was telling me this group of people is higher risk, and another teacher was telling me this group of people was at lower risk. And someone was telling me that suicide is preventable, and someone was saying there's nothing you can do to prevent suicide. And so I had to really go into the data at a very early time in my career. And so I'm used to battling the common myths about suicide. Like,
yes,
there's a bimodal distribution and it's more common in the elderly and adolescent, which is absolutely not true. It's most common in middle life. Or the lifetime risk of schizophrenia suicide is 10% when it's less than half than that, probably about 4.2. So I'm used to those types of myths.
Yes.
I never imagined in 2020 that I'd be fighting Donald Trump, that I'd be fighting, you know, politically motivated evocations of suicide by people who actually don't care about youth suicide whatsoever.
Right.
But what they care about is ending lockdowns or returning the economy. You know, Trump, it was all about the economy. We need to get people back to work.
Yeah.
So he would invoke that there would be far more suicides. In 2020, he was saying there'd be far more suicides than there would be deaths of COVID, which of course is a laughable statement
right.
in 2024. But then very quickly, the experts in mental health, the media experts, who often aren't mental health experts, are usually doctors in other fields, but they're brought on like, and I don't want to call out certain names, like a famous CNN medical contributor who is a surgeon who doesn't have mental health experience will be brought on to talk about mental health. And I never mind that because a lot of doctors work with mental health. And
absolutely. Absolutely.
But the problem is when they start getting nuanced questions and they lean into the myths that they were taught, they lean into the untruths that they believe. They saw a graph 5 years ago that showed that suicides were rising. And so they said, well, suicides are rising. But of course, suicides dropped in 2019 across the world.
Right.
And that's before the pandemic. So, you know, these people were making these proclamations. And so as we headed into 2020, we had a new sort of pressure in that we had a bunch of people who were politically motivated to say that suicides will rise because we need to end lockdowns and get people back into the economy. And then we had a bunch of quote-unquote experts going out there saying that there would be a shadow pandemic, that there would be a tenfold risk of suicide. There was a publication by a University of Toronto researcher who claimed that suicides would increase tremendously because of the unemployment rate. And all over the news, it was suicides increasing. And myself and a few others, Stan Kuchar, senator now for Canada, but formerly of Dalhousie University, and I were just out there talking to the media saying, hold on, we are really bad at predicting suicide. Like the idea that the average person could say, oh, I know what's going to happen because of a worldwide pandemic is ridiculous. We don't even know what's going to happen to our patients in the next week,
yeah.
let alone what's going to happen to the world in the course of a year.
Yes.
So to battle that misinformation has been truly surreal. And so to make it really clear, in Canada, suicides have decreased significantly since the pandemic has started in every age group that we've measured it. There's a few exceptions. There's not been much of a drop in middle-aged women. It's equivocal, so it's neither an increase nor a decrease when you use statistical methods. But there was a drop in kids, and of course, kids were evoked almost all the time in the lockdown and school closure fight. There was a drop down in young adults. There was a drop down in most adults. There was a drop down in elderly people. In all, there was 16% less suicides in the pandemic years than there were in the years leading up to the pandemic.
16% fewer yeah. suicides during the pandemic years.
And, you know, when I try to put that into context there, you know, suicide is a fluctuant rate. Things will make it go up and down. And there are, you know, Canada has a population of about, you know, at this point, 40 million, and mm-hmm. the rate of suicide is about 10 per 100,000 per year. So you can imagine a few suicides influence the rate.
Yes.
But to drop 16% over the course of 3 years and hold, this is unprecedented. It's just simply unprecedented. So, you know, instead of us asking like what, you know, what's wrong and how are we going to fight this stem of suicide epidemic that never came, we should really be asking, why did Canadian suicides drop so much during the pandemic?
What would be your guess?
You know, I try really hard to limit myself in being too authoritative on this because, of course, the data speaks to me and then I share the data and then everyone else can interpret what that means. When I see things like in America, suicides dropped about 4% less than trends, and in Canada, things dropped about 16 to 17% less than trends. And then I look at all the differences in how Canada handled the pandemic with the CERB benefit and a basic universal income for most Canadians who are basically given, you know, enough money to survive without working for quite a while.
such a huge difference between Cuba and the U.S. in that.
And you look at America, and they had a huge influence, a huge uptick in gun purchases during the pandemic.
Right.
And of course, Canada doesn't have those gun runs during times of calamity. So there are so many differences between different places that we look. I look at the economic supports that the government gave, you know, all credit to this government. I think the economic deployment of the CERB benefit, of really making it clear that businesses would be supported during this time so that businesses didn't have to force people. Mm-hmm. And then Canada did better than our southern neighbors on pandemic restrictions. We did worse than many of our other colleagues in like New Zealand and Australia. And then there's probably the pull together effect in times of calamity. This has been seen before when there's floods, when there's earthquakes, when there's world wars and things like that. We do see suicides downtick a little bit. And there's almost like a society decides we got to get through this. And that changes the mindset of the population. But knowing exactly why, you know, I leave that up to, you know, this is going to be decades of research. You know, I imagine this is going to be at least a decade and a half of thorough research. You know, when you know, for example, that suicidality increased in young girls, but it didn't increase in young boys, and suicide rates didn't change in young girls, and suicide rates dropped in young boys. How do you interpret that? Like, that's very complex. Like, it can't just be that schools were closed because both boys and girls go to school. It can't just be that it was a more stressful time for girls because even though suicidality went up, suicides didn't go up. And if suicides didn't go up, then maybe that's the system working. Maybe there was so much focus on reach out for mental health that we had more calls.
Right.
It could be that we had a chicken and egg effect, that we focused, you know, you heard so much about mental health during the pandemic.
Yes.
That maybe a whole bunch of people decided, now's the time I'm going to start talking about my mental health.
And maybe it actually works to take mental health seriously and recognize the importance of self-care.
You know, and I remember that early in the pandemic, you know, one of the big things that all these quote unquote experts would cling to would be ER calls or ambulance calls for suicide crisis went up. But of course, if we now know that those went up and suicides went down, then that's exactly what we want. That is the system designed as intended. We want suicidal people to call for help and not die.
Yes.
And we know for sure that not enough people were calling before the pandemic. So if there was an increase in suicidal calls to ambulances, is that necessarily a bad thing? Or are we just getting the responses that we wanted to get before the pandemic? So trying to sort all this out is really hard. I like to do the data presentation. I'm a bit of an Excel geek and a data monkey. I love just going through charts and
this is more data I can get off, right? You know,
I got an email on the weekend from one of the directors of New South Wales in Australia. They had a health database that he wanted to share with me. And I just spent the weekend going through the numbers and was able to create some really cool graphs about ER access utilization during the pandemic and suicides during the pandemic in this, you know, state of Australia, and compare it to Victoria, which had more lockdowns and things like this. And so, you know, it's one of these things where, you know, I like presenting the data, and then I try to just leave the interpretations the way that authors should leave them. You know how when you write a paper, you have to leave like why it's important.
Yeah.
And authors always love to overstate this.
Yeah.
They always like to say this could herald a new treatment for, you know, bipolar disorder that will never be, you know, reached in the history of mankind.
Absolutely.
But in reality, what I can just say is let the data say, this is remarkable. There is a true effect here. And it is really incumbent on us, if we're going to be serious experts in research, to figure out why, you know, for most suicides dropped. And I even qualify that. I know some people suffered during the pandemic. I imagine there's some people whose loneliness or isolation or lockdowns during the pandemic made things worse. So even though I believe that suicides overall went down in Canada, I'm not speaking to every Canadian, and it's up to us to figure out who did well and who didn't.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's the thing, isn't it? Because what we're really, of course, talking about here is correlation.
Yeah. Right? National data.
It's really, I mean, yeah, it's striking, and, you know, it's a great source of hypothesis, but we'll never be able to prove a damn thing with it.
Yeah.
Right.
And I'm so much more,
that's all we can do.
Yeah. I'm so much more comfortable in that space because of my clinical work in suicide risk assessment, yes. Because, you know, most doctors, most medical doctors, they're used to having a triage mechanism. I have the Ottawa ankle rules to help me sort out fractures that need x-rays versus fractures versus right. ankles that don't need x-rays.
Right.
And we don't have that in suicide. Our best prediction efforts are no better than a positive predictive value of 1%, perhaps.
Wow.
So I'm always used to being in this gray space where I don't really understand why things happen. I just know what I could do. So for example, if I know that someone's suicidal, I just look for any stresses I can find in their life to make them better. And anything in their life that would make their life better and add that and remove anything in their life that would make their life worse. Whether that's a depression or a family conflict or school stress or whatever it is, I don't get to know which of my interventions would save or not save a life. I'll never get to know that.
Right.
And so I'm very used to being in this gray space of having the data, having the knowledge, but not exactly knowing the why.
And it's always challenging as well, because suicide is inherently rare, as you said, 10 yeah. out of 100,000 or whatever, right?
Yeah. And
it's going to be far more attempts and crises. And, you know, I once knew a psychiatrist years ago in my training, you know, who basically said, you know, you can always safely walk away from the suicidal patient because statistically they're very unlikely to complete it. And I was like, horrified. Mm-hmm. That was some bad advice.
But yeah, you shouldn't walk away from any suicidal patient. But you know, statistically, if you were a computer and you were a prediction algorithm and you were just programmed to say this person won't die, you'd be right 99.998% of the time.
That's right.
Right. So you'd be an amazingly sensitive computer. Like exactly. your parameters of your test, even if you had 1,000 people, would be real, real good.
That's right.
You only have one false negative. Oh my God. You know? it takes a lot of you know, you have to get really comfortable with this gray space. And I think in psychology, in psychiatry, we get used to this.
Yes.
I don't really care why my patients got better when they come back and tell me that they got better.
Yes.
Maybe I started medication for them. Maybe I sent them to do some CBT. Maybe I enrolled them in a group to help them with their sobriety. Maybe I wrote a letter that got them out of school or whatever it was.
Or maybe you sat there and you listened.
Yeah, just was kind.
Right.
And four weeks later, they come back to me and say, "Doc, I'm feeling so much better.
Yes.
Everything's good. Do you think I should continue the medication?" I'll say, "I don't know. I'm just glad you're better. You know, for yeah. now, let's keep things going. And I'll tell you the risks of continuing medications and not. But I'm just so thrilled you're doing better."
Yes.
And I don't get to know which of the things in the last 4 weeks made this person's life better. And I think that's that gray space that we live in mental health is unappealing to the simple stories that the common public have about mental health.
Right.
You know, whether it's there's a school shooting, we need to increase resource in mental health.
Right.
Well, I'd ask you, what would you do if you had a school shooter in your office and you knew that they were going to do a school shooting? What would you do? I mean, you could call the police. You could, how could you fix that? You know,
I have no idea. It's interesting in our office because we have, you know, I look at the design of our office. We have one entrance and that's it. I mean, I've got a great yeah. big window in front of me. I can smash and I can escape onto the roof. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, honestly, I will never know until I'm in that circumstance.
Yeah. And we're mental health professionals. Exactly. And everybody says that, you know, when someone has a problem like that, they should talk to us. But of course, we don't have easy solutions for that. How many times as a mental health professional have I been in the situation where the person that I'm seeing, their problem is entirely financial?
Yes.
I can't prescribe money.
Yeah.
I'd love to.
Yeah.
What an amazing intervention. I think, you know, if we were serious at looking at how suicide's reduced in Canada, we might say that prescribing money actually might work.
We did an entire episode on that.
There is a growing pool of social prescription research as well, looking at prescribed time off work, prescribed time in recreation, sponsored things that the government will pay for, like allowing someone to play laser tag on the government's dime. You know, like there are research for social prescriptions that show, you know, maybe we could prescribe money.
Yes.
But I can say really, you know, it's such an uncomfortable space to be in, to have the public have such a black and white view of what mental health is or what suicide is, and then to have the knowledge of just how complicated mental health and suicide are.
It truly is. Talk to me a little bit more about how you go about, you know, like when you're doing that, you know, I assume you're in an ER.
Yeah.
Actually, I don't know any. Where do you work? What is your setup?
So I do work in a tertiary emergency department for kids. I also work at student health at a university. So I see a young adult, mostly population, in my outpatient work. I see an emerging, you know, emergency pediatric population in my other job. And then every once in a while, I do outreach work to a general outpatient clinic in an underserved area in BC. And so I get a broad range, you know, I get the general outpatient stuff, you know, I've been anxious and it's been a year and I wonder if there's something wrong with me type questions, to the very tertiary, I think this person could be catatonic and they might need ECT.
Right.
I have quite a wide range of clinical approaches. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, certainly in my practice, you know, I mean, we don't refer every person who says, gee, I thought about killing myself to ER.
Yeah.
Right. Because if we did that, we would never stop sending people to ER. Yeah. Right. It's so common. You know, we need to engage in a process of trying to understand what the level of severity is, trying to estimate, you know, essentially that risk. And of course, balancing that against, if that person is saying, I don't want to go, and as a psychologist, by the way, here in Ontario, the only option I have is to phone the police, right? And because it has to be a physician to sign that document to get them admitted. So I have to count on the police accepting my advice that this person needs to be apprehended and, you know, taken to a hospital. So it's going to destroy the therapeutic relationship. So there's always that tension there, right? You gotta be careful about that assessment. And as you say, what do we got?
Exactly. It's so tough.
It's
so tough. You know, I always start with two foundations. Number one is I want to make sure that everything I do with the people that I work with is to their benefit. Mm-hmm. So I stay focused more on benefit than I do on risk, because of course I'm going to worry about most of my patients that tell me that they're suicidal. And risk has a way of making you, like, especially when you don't have a good model for assessing risk and you overvalue risk, you'll make bad decisions. So there are people who we know will have a very negative experience in hospital, either because of their previous trauma history or because there are many hospitals that are not, unfortunately, welcoming spaces for people who have repetitive or repeat, you know, suicide presentations. They're often treated very differently.
Yes.
When you have people who have disabilities, we know that people with disabilities are treated differently in hospitals. So there's real risks to even sending someone to hospital, not to mention hurting your relationship with them. And so you always want to think, what would be my biggest benefit? What would be my best benefit? If sitting with you right now and hearing about this and getting that suicidality to peak and then valley, and we can go through that together and we can come up with a plan on what happens if it peaks again, might be better than, oh, it's peaking, we should send them to hospital. I see a lot of people, when the person starts saying, I think I'm really going to do it, they sort of shut down the interview, they call the police, or they, if they're a psychiatrist, they'll certify, or a doctor, they'll certify.
Right.
And
right.
We know about most people's suicidal is that it does kind of, it hits a peak and then it comes down after that. I can't, you know, tell you how many kids I've seen after an attempt, and the first thing out of their mouth is, well, that was stupid, I shouldn't have done that. Right. You know, like the urgency of the issue is over.
That's right.
So
discharge, in a sense.
You really have to think about the person in front of you, try to get to know them the best you can. And, you know, I've said this before, there's a great podcast that I did with Mark Mullen. It's called The Psychiatry Boot Camp for Residents. And we did one on suicide risk assessment. And I really try to drive home the point that to be a really good suicide preventing mental health professional, you need to be a really good human to your patients. That's where it starts.
Absolutely.
If, If you're a really good checklist robot, if you're a really good applier of the Columbia suicide screen, if you're a really good smart person who knows all the meds, if you're a really good cognitive behavioral therapist, you won't do as well as if you start by being a really good human. Because if that person doesn't need cognitive behavioral therapy or the screen would miss them, you won't benefit them with all of your skills.
And that's exactly the same reality in psychotherapy outcome research, yeah. right? It's 15% technique and 60% relationship.
The old purple hat theory.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. It's absolutely, you know, so validating, frankly, to hear that.
It's funny because people, you know, I've in my career, I've probably seen over 10, maybe 12,000, 13,000 suicidal kids in severe crisis. And, you know, people always think, oh my God, you know, you must really be able to know and all this. And the one thing that I try to do with every kid that I see, every family that I see, is they get to work with the genuine me. If something shocks me, I act shocked. If something upsets me, I act upset. If I seem sad, it's because I am sad. If I'm worried, I say, I'm really worried. And by being an honest and genuine human, the person in front of me knows that I can lay it out on their feet, and at least they're going to give me their best. Yes. They're not going to go through a script. They're not going to say, oh, you mentioned suicide, so I must call 911 now. They're going to say, why did you tell me this? I mean, I always ask the therapist, think about this. Of all the people to tell about suicidal thinking, the one person you shouldn't is the one who has a professional responsibility to call the cops.
That's right.
Right? So when they tell you I'm suicidal, they're also saying, I'm sharing this with you. There is a message in there. There is a knowledge that you could get in their way. There is probably an opening of trust, or at least a window of vulnerability. And so when you really think about it, one of the least suicidal things you can do is tell your therapist you're suicidal.
That's right.
Right?
That's right.
And so that's a very relieving thought to me when kids tell me that. You know, I know many doctors who get really worried when they hear the suicide word, but I always take it as an honor. I'm always like, I'm so, you know, one of my commonest phrases in the ER is, I'm so glad you've told me this. I actually can help you. Or I'm so glad I get to see you, because there's many people I don't get to see. And when I express it in those ways, again, being a real human being, it genuinely comes through. I am really glad to see them. I know that 80% of people who die of suicide die on their first attempt. So all the people that I see are of a group who I, you know, 80% I would never get to see.
Yeah.
You know, if I think of anyone I see who could die by suicide, 80% of them would die before I got to see them. So I, you know, I'm so lucky to be in the position that I am when I'm talking to them, and I try to transmit that. And then I try to remember, wait, they shared with me they're suicidal. You know, that's a pretty anti-suicidal move.
And that sense that you bring to it, which is so obvious, of being honored by, you know, that relationship and that honesty and that trust, you know, that compassion, that's where the power really lies.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I'll know lots of people who go through, do everything technically well. Mm-hmm. But when you watch it, if you watch it on a video camera, you see that person, the person that they're talking to is looking up and trying to look in their eyes, and that person is looking down at their checklist. And that person who's doing that is so worried about suicide, and they care, and they really want their patient to do well. Mm-hmm. But there's some fundamentals of mental health care, which is put down the pencil. Like, I know documentation is important, but you need to figure out a way to document very briefly, and after you see your patient. You can't be looking at a screen or looking at your, you know, your pencil while a patient is telling you important details about their life. It just ruins the therapeutic relationship.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think a lot of time that's about our own anxiety, right? Yeah. As the clinician, you know, owning that sense of responsibility, right? And I love that phrase that you use of let go of the risk, focus on the benefit.
Yeah.
Right. Which I've never heard anywhere else. I think that's completely unique in my experience.
Well, I think we're trained, you know, there's two unfortunate things about being in Canadian healthcare. One is most of our information comes from the United States, where litigiousness rules the day. Absolutely. I mean, medical legal concerns are 99.99% of all hospital decisions in the United States. Clinical matters to those who have those ethics. But if you were to ask any administrator, any hospital, they're going to follow the medical legal book, you know, 9 times out of 10. In Canada, we don't have that same medical legal environment, so there's less to fear in terms of being sued for getting it wrong.
Right.
And then because of that, we should be less rigid. But I think we kind of inherit a lot of our American friends' training. We inherit their scales and their scores and their pathways and their mandates. I've seen hospitals when a person is suicidal, they mandate no writing implements because they are sharp. Well, you have someone on an inpatient unit and you're taking away tools to draw and write. Are you really thinking this through? Yeah. Like, is that really suicide preventing or is that crazy making? Is that going to make someone much, much, much worse?
Yeah.
So these policies and these ideas that we have about risk are distorted probably from our Southern influence, but also by our lack of sort of really thinking, what is the true high risk condition? If I had a hospital that was comfortable, that maybe, you know, there would be an area that would need to be very safe for people who couldn't keep themselves. But if I prioritized comfort and not safety, I'm really certain that outcomes would be better than if I prioritized safety and not comfort. I'm very certain about that.
Absolutely. One of the striking things that always, you know, sticks with me through my career is I did my internship at University Hospital in London, mm-hmm. which was had infection control out the window. The thing was carpeted. There was carpet, right? It was a beautiful environment. It was it didn't have enough windows, but I mean, at least it had an architecturally interesting building to be in, and you know the carpeting was muffling of the sounds and the environment. It was a really nice space. And the other buildings I spent time in before I went into private practice, two of them were early 20th century former nursing student residents, which mm-hmm. is a really remarkably specific thing to have two of in your career. And they were run down and falling apart. And, you know, they had a certain, you know, shabby university dorm, you know, feel to them. But, you know, they were just like, you know, the floors were all wavy and the mm-hmm. buildings just felt like they were about to tumble over. Mm-hmm. And I was really struck by what that was telling me about how mental health was valued in the system, right?
Or even just the silliness of calling that mental health, you know, like you knew going there, it was depressing to go there. I mean, it felt horrible to walk. You know, I worked in one of the oldest hospitals in Canada, and I remember, you know, the basement where we would assess patients, it looked like a prison. If you had told me it was a prison, I'd have believed you. Yeah. And you know, when I would be there, I'd feel the pressure and the weight of it. So,
absolutely.
Hey, OnSeg listeners, Katie here from Jane. I wanted to take a few seconds to say you're doing incredible work. Whether you're a receptionist, office manager, practitioner, or all of the above, we see your commitment to your clients. Jane was built to help you transform that commitment into a thriving business, all while making your day-to-day easier. You can head to jane.app/mental health to read more and see if we can be a good fit for your practice.
I want to go back to that wonderful thread because I was curious about the impact of school and the school year.
Yeah.
Right? As if I'm not mistaken, and correct me if I'm wrong, you're going to know this better than I do, but if I'm not mistaken, suicide actually drops in the summertime for school-aged children. Is that not true?
Yeah, it's the rest of life, we see a gradual increase until summer, and then it goes down until a nadir, usually around the end of the year. That busts one of those myths that holidays are more frequent for suicides. For the rest of life, after school age, we see a summer peak. And in fact, interestingly, in Australia, we see a winter peak. So we think that it's correlated not to darkness, but to heat. Because it's actually suicide rates are lowest in Australia and Canada and America when it is darkest. But so isn't that interesting? You know, it goes against what we think about seasonality and mood. It goes against what we think about seasonality. When it comes to kids, however, they fall in an entirely different seasonal trend. We see a decrease in July and August in Canada. We see an increase in September through November. We see a decrease in December. We see an increase in January through May. And then we see a decrease in June heading towards July.
And pattern.
that pattern, when you look at it, I did an article. I was really, really, one of the coolest moments of my life. You know, I was always a young geek. So I was a geek my whole life. So I was a young geek. And so I used to read all these magazines like Popular Science and Scientific American and all these. In 2022, the editors of Scientific American asked me to write an article on school and suicide. And I did. And we went through 7 billion person years of suicide in children between the years of 1999 to 2019. And when you look at the graph and you look at the heat map where it's, you know, weekdays and months, you can clearly see the school year. It's as clear as day. You see suicides from Monday to Friday, January to May, and then suicides Monday to Friday, September through November. And it's stark. It's 60% more likely to happen.
That is so striking. So what that would suggest is a reasonable hypothesis, of course, is that being in school is stressful.
Definitely. And I don't think you'd have to go much beyond listening to the average child to reinforce that. Like that isn't just, oh, there's a correlation here. We know that 80% of kids find school stressful. 60% of kids say that school is a major cause of stress in their life. And in high school, that creeps up to 83% at least in a 2014 American Psychological Association study. So we know that kids find school stressful. And I always try to point this out that what this is a correlation of suicides on the day of schools. That doesn't necessarily mean that school is directly responsible for it, but it certainly means that if we wanted to look at ways and interventions and things to target that could possibly reduce suicide in kids, we might want to look at school-based things, it's the social end of it or the academic of it or the hours of it or the homework or the way that teachers treat kids or the amount of work they have to do or the way that parents put expectations on the kids or whatever it is.
Yeah.
With that relationship, it tells us that if we wanted to have an impactful influence on suicide rates, we could probably reduce them to weekend levels. And guess what? We got those levels during the first 6 months of the pandemic.
Yes.
Suicide.
Yes. And we're not saying, I want to be clear, we're not saying that wasn't a stressful time.
Right. We're saying that kids without in-person school in the United States in March, April, May, and June of 2020 had the same suicide rate that they did in July of 2020. That has never happened in the history of America. Remember, I've told you that pattern, that it's always been higher in March and then heading down to July.
That's right.
It's never happened in the history of America that those 3 months prior to July were at par with, actually 4 months were at par with July. So March, April, May, June was flat. And it was a huge drop from where February was. And so, you know, people were so quick to say, let's get kids back to school for their mental health. And I was like, hold on, we actually have an opportunity here. Let's see how we can, for adding a stressful pandemic to kids, let's make school easier. That was my whole pitch. It wasn't we should keep kids home forever. It's we need to really look at making schools safer places for kids' mental health.
Yes. Yes. And granted, I mean, like I said, I mean, there was a lot of stress going on.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I remember.
We saw surveys go up, surveys of distress go up. And I never want to equate suicide to mental health. You know, how people are doing is different than the suicide rates. But we saw similar trends in ER presentations for suicidality. We saw similar trends in suicide attempt presentations. Not for girls, but yes, for boys. And then really interestingly, most of the longitudinal data out of Canada, where we took kids from before the pandemic and followed them over the pandemic, shows quite a variety of results. You know, some kids doing worse, some kids doing better, most doing about the same. And that's not what most of the experts would have predicted. You know, they would right. have seen those survey numbers early on in the pandemic, and they would have said, we're going to have huge increases in mental health problems. And we're not really seeing that.
Yes, 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 exactly. I was curious. Have you ever taken a look at the numbers in Japan? And it's relationship yeah. To the school year.
Yeah, so there's two nations where there's been a seasonality established the way that, you know, I was able to do it for America. There was a 2013 article that also did it to a little bit less of a degree in America. Unfortunately, in Canada, we don't have the monthly suicide data of kids. That would be a great research project yes. if anyone wants to do it.
Yeah.
To see if we could see the same seasonality. I suspect we would. But you would need all of Canada's suicides just because of the numbers difference. Remember, there's 10 times as many right. people in America as there are here. But in Japan and in the UK, their suicide trends follow their term system. So Japan has a different term system for school, mm-hmm. and the UK has a different term system for school, and both ER presentations and suicide rates for school-age kids follow those term programs as well. So when school is in, suicide rates are higher, suicide presentations to emergency departments are higher. When school is out, they're lower. And there was a new article in Australia in 2021 showing the same thing for ER presentations for kids. Just a, you know, they have a four-term system with a month break in between each term. And those months just drop.
Yes.
And it's so compelling.
Now, the reason I was curious about Japan is, as I understand it, the school year is longer, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
So they're spending yeah. more time in school, and yet that data still supports
yeah.
the process.
Japan is a tricky one to read for two reasons. It's hard to make comparisons for Japan's suicide numbers because they don't really have the same coroner system we do. The police report suicides.
I see.
And so the advantage of that is the suicide numbers come up really well, mm-hmm. like very quickly. The downside is I'm not sure how to compare that to coroner adjudicated suicides right. you know, that take 6 to 8 months to investigate, like here in Canada,
right?
Because we might not be comparing the same things at all.
Yeah.
You know, what does a drug overdose look like of a kid in Japan? If a cop comes in and says, oh, they killed themselves, they check the suicide box.
Yes.
You know, it's difficult to compare those numbers, but Japan did have a rise, whatever their numbers are, a pretty strong rise heading into the pandemic of school-age kids dying by suicide. So it was quite a sharp graph from 2015 to 2020. The rates stabilized a little bit, but they were really sharply heading up prior to the pandemic as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just such a fascinating area.
Yeah. You know? I mean, there's weird facts that I hold in my head. Like, I've never gotten around to tweeting about this, but Italy, for example, boasts a suicide rate somewhere around 4 or 5 per 100,000.
Wow.
Which is half of what Canada's rate is, but I don't buy it. I personally don't buy it. I know that the coroners are all Catholic. I know that, or mostly there's a lot of Catholic coroners. I don't want to say all Italians are Catholic. I know that there is a large stigma against suicide. Suicide is all obviously in Italian culture is quite a mortal sin. And so I never know how to compare, Italian numbers to Canadian numbers, because if I were to look at it, I'd say, wow, Canada has a lot to learn from Italy. And we might, but it's really hard to even compare those numbers. So I always look at the Italian numbers or I look at another nation's numbers and I go, oh, that's interesting. But I'm so aware of how culturally different I am from my southern neighbor, let alone, you know, Italy or exactly. Spain or, you know, I'm just so aware of how culturally different we are that I'm not even sure cross-country comparisons are that helpful overall. I think until we figure out ways to isolate those things, we'll always be dealing with more confounder than fact.
Oh, absolutely. And I was just thinking, you know, that's such a huge piece of this, isn't it? Because the role of culture mm-hmm. is one of those variables, and then the role of culture in how it gets reported. And so you get these, you know, these interactions like that. Yeah, really.
Yeah, we find a trend of, I remember early in my training, there was a lot about religiosity and suicide. And, you know, the impact of the religion of the coroner was the largest, piece of that.
Wow. The impact of the religion of the coroner
yes,
had an impact on whether or not a death is identified as suicide.
Yeah.
Wow.
And the, you know, when we look at, you know, we still think that religiosity is an important protective factor. Of course, it probably has to do with the sense of community and belonging and greater purpose. But then there are some aspects of religiosity that I suspect are a hindrance, like you have to be perfect. You have to confess everything. When you make a mistake, you could go to hell. Like, you know, depending on the types of religions, there can be really strict prohibitions.
Yes.
Certain people are told that they're not good or they're evil for being who they are. So that brings me into another really important point about what we think about risk factors, which is every risk factor has a context.
Yes.
You know, we know that being widowed, or saying being divorced, for example, you're 1.6 times more likely to die of suicide if you're a man. But what if you're divorced from an abusive relationship?
Right.
I suspect your suicide risk has improved, not deteriorated. We know that people who are transgender are more likely to die of suicide. We don't think it's because they're transgender. We think it's because it's how society treats them. But I imagine it's a lot easier to be transgender in Vancouver right now than it is in Florida right now.
Oh, my goodness.
And so every risk factor we're aware of, whether it's depression, are you better or are you still suffering? Is treatment working? Is it not?
Yeah.
Or if you're male, you know, everything that we think of has a context to it. And that context applies to how you're going to assess their risk.
Right.
You know, there's many people who I've had who have a number of check boxes. They have a former history of suicide. They've been hospitalized many times. They've been on many medications, but this is the best I've ever seen them.
Yeah.
And even though they have all those checkboxes, I know that their risk position has improved,
right,
not deteriorated.
Their history, oddly enough, hasn't changed a great deal.
Yeah, it hasn't. Right? And people often think, oh, how could you send that person home? They have so many risk factors. I'm like, what can I do to change their history? You know, their history is their history.
Exactly. And I've seen a lot of, risk assessment forms that focus on the demographics, right?
Yes.
You know,
yeah.
Oh, this is a 53-year-old man, you know, and
yeah,
it's like, you have to assess the person, not the surface.
In fact, since about 2015, we have compelling evidence to suggest that our attempts to stratify people into high and low risk suicide is more harmful than helpful. Because of course, we know in a practical managed care environment like Canada, suicidal people are sort of escalated in priority, and people who are deemed not suicidal are de-escalated in priority.
Right.
And if you were thinking about this commonsensically, you might want to prioritize the people who aren't yet suicidal,
right,
especially if you can't predict who is suicidal.
Yes.
But our systems are designed around this notion that we can identify high-risk people, even though we know we can't.
Right.
We can... What we should always be laser focused on is, for the person that I'm seeing, what do they need to improve their life? And we should be focused a lot less on, do they meet enough criteria to be considered high risk so they qualify for service X, or so that I send them to hospital or not?
Right.
Because of course, sending someone to hospital is unlikely to modify someone's risk, unless you have a plan for what you're going to do to improve their risk in hospital.
Yeah. Because I so often see it, you know, the hospital is, we need to contain this, right?
Yeah.
We need to contain this risk. It's not about helping the person. Mm-hmm. It's about controlling them.
Right? Yeah.
And I guess
that control will end.
Yeah.
You know, there is good research to suggest that the first 24 hours of care is really important. Mm-hmm. You know, if someone is hospitalized, there might be a strong benefit to that first, mm-hmm, come in, let's talk about it, let's get to know your situation, let's figure this out.
Yes.
I doubt that the evidence would be as robust for continuing stays based off of the idea of risk.
Yeah.
Because at some point you have to end your hold.
Yes.
You know, if the person just sits there in their chair and refuses to talk to you, at some point you have to discharge them.
Yeah.
And you can't keep them forever.
That's right.
So your plan had better be something that will improve their life, not just we'll wait for the risk to get better.
Yeah. 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 Totally shifting gears.
Yes.
Let's talk about that other magnificent thread of yours that I deploy on a regular basis, the UK excess mortality data.
Yeah, who knew? I mean, this is kind of cool because I do have such expertise in mortality data.
Right.
That, you know, because my most of my scientific knowledge, most of my data work is expressed in deaths per 100,000 per year and adjusting for age and these types of things. And so UK has a really weird system where deaths are registered not on the date of death, but on the date of registration.
Okay.
And that has a huge impact for suicides, which can take more than a year to adjudicate.
Right.
So when you see UK's suicide rates, you always want to look, is it by year of registration?
Right.
Or is it by year of death? Because you might not actually be seeing the death rate of that year. But when it comes to non-suicide deaths, and this is where, you know, the anti-vaxxers, and sorry, I don't, there's some people that find anti-vaxxer very pejorative. I don't mean to say that people can't question safety.
Absolutely.
Or that people can't scientifically inquire about whether a product is good. When I say anti-vaxxer, I mean people who are determined to prove that, people who are sure that vaccines harm, people who don't want anyone to receive any vaccines or believe that the vaccination schedule causes more harm than good.
Or they want to shut down anyone who is attempting to promote.
We have more than enough evidence to show that every vaccine on our schedule, whether it's MMR all the way through to now, undoubtedly COVID will become part of our schedule, has been extremely robustly researched to be both safe and effective.
Yes.
That's the only way they make it to the schedule.
Right.
There are vaccines that haven't made it to the schedule because they haven't demonstrated effectiveness. So if it was all just about making pharma richer or, you know, whatever, there'd be a lot of more vaccines than we currently have.
Yeah.
So in England, what I was able to do in this thread and the one that you're referring to is there is a database of deaths by vaccination status. And the anti-vaxxers had really capitalized on this because they didn't understand the data in it. So it had all these deaths, and then it had these populations. And so what they were often doing is they were taking one of the groups that were vaccinated, say, people on their fourth dose, and they were looking at their mortality rate. But someone who is on their fourth dose in the UK is going to have a very different health profile than someone who is just getting their second dose in the UK. So comparing mortality like that is really challenging.
Mm-hmm.
But what I was able to do is actually, because I have such mortality expertise, is I was able to weight the vaccinated people. So the group that was largest vaccinated had the largest weight in terms of the overall mortality. And by doing that, I was able to show really conclusively, like without doubt, at every age range, you know, I was able to drop it up, I think, by 15 or 20 year age ranges, that vaccinated people survived COVID, you know, at a much higher rate than unvaccinated people did. But vaccinated people had lower all-cause mortality.
Yes.
And in some cases by 16%, you know, older groups much higher than that, you know, overall the effect was quite large. And the importance of that wasn't to me teaching me something, because I know that vaccines are safe and effective because I actually understand the science that goes into them. You know, any anti-vaxxer who says that they aren't well-researched doesn't understand research. Anyone who says there isn't safe doesn't understand how unsafe driving a car is.
Right.
Like we are very certain about the safety profile of most of the things. And you know, even a simple thing, like look at how quickly they yanked Johnson & Johnson for a handful of blood clots.
Exactly.
Like they just yanked it from the market.
Yeah.
You know, and it wasn't like a whole bunch of people died. It was like a safety signal of like 16 people and boop, it's gone.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And, but this data was being used, the same UK data set was being used by anti-vaxxers to show that vaccines harm. And of course, I never imagined, I've always been a debunker.
Yes.
You know, I've taken on the MSG causes headaches myth and all these type of things, you know, back in the early internet days. But I've never imagined to have like such a strong anti-vax fight. I've never thought that my career would take me in these directions. Like there's times where I'm fighting with Elon Musk or his acolytes, or I'm in Twitter wars with, you know, former Nobel Prize laureates who are all anti-vax cranks now because of Nobel syndrome.
Nobel syndrome.
And a fascinating phenomenon, like one to look into. Like it is really quite interesting how these really accomplished scientific people, I think, you know, Elon Musk isn't that accomplished scientifically, but he's also a great example of it. Well, people who confuse them getting there with how they got there.
Yes.
So like there are really famous Nobel laureates who went into really strange, crank places because they thought that they were the genius, not that the work that they put in, the effort that they put in, the teams that they worked with, the expertise they accrued, the academics they learned was part of that genius. Right. They just thought, I'm the genius. I'll figure out all the other world's problems. So yeah, I was literally in Twitter wars with, I won't mention names, but Nobel laureates who were looking at mortality data, and they were saying, oh, look, COVID's over. The mortality dropped in the last week. I'm like, there's a weak leg.
Yeah.
That data is showing 3 deaths because all the data hasn't been reported yet. And this same Nobel laureate would come back to me and say, why would they report it then? I'm like, because it's up-to-date reporting with a published lag. Yeah. That's how it works. And I actually showed him an animated GIF of the trails, like, correcting each week as they added more deaths to it. And I said, this week will be no different. COVID is not over. He said, with the certainty of everything, I am 100% certain that COVID is over. And of course, this was, what, June of 2020? And who thought I'd be arguing with a Nobel laureate about the COVID being over in June of 2020?
He's off just by a little bit, you know.
Just a bit.
Rounding error.
COVID continued. But yeah, so, you know, there's a very good organization that I've been able to be involved with in Canada called Science Up First. It's headed by, I've mentioned, Stan Kuchar from the Senate of Canada. He's been able to secure really great unfettered funding for a group of scientists to battle misinformation. So we always try to put out the best information that we can. You know, one of the brains behind it is Tim Caulfield, who does so much misinformation research out of the University of Alberta, professor of law there, and just brilliant people. But battling misinformation online, especially in Twitter, has become such a toxic place.
It really
makes you wonder. Like I wonder daily how long I'll continue to do it.
Yeah. How does it affect you?
Twitter is the worst of humanity. In the same way, I've made incredible connections. I was part of an authorship out of Duke University looking at ICU deaths during the pandemic that totally arose out of my work through Twitter. Yes. I did a paper showing the errors in a meta-analysis of cardiac mortality with 3 PhDs, one from Maryland and 2 from Australia. That was entirely through Twitter.
Yeah.
So some of the best people I've ever met, some of my best career moves, some of the most amazing moments of my life being on the Mehdi Hasan show to talk about schools. These are things that I would have never been able to do without Twitter. I know that for a fact.
Right.
So I have some degree of gratitude for the platform. I have a modest following. I think I posted something, you probably saw it maybe about a week ago, about all the hate that I've received, all of the various accusations or threats that I'll be hanged, like in Nuremberg.
Right.
Who throw insults about my appearance or tell me that I'm going to die or tell me that I'm the scum of the earth or, you know, and this is just a daily occurrence. And of course, Twitter's gone private with Elon Musk and has gone to a place of virtually very little moderation. Where I remember the checkmark used to be a symbol of, oh, that's a source I can trust. And now if I see a checkmark, I know they're about to insult me.
Yeah.
It really does affect me in negative ways. I'm a very privileged person. You know, one of the major things I've done in my career is really thought a lot about how amazingly privileged I am to be a white colonizer in Canada. Mm-hmm. I really do think a lot about how privileged I am, and I never want my whining. I make a lot of money as a psychiatrist. I live in a comfortable home. I don't have so many afflictions that people face. But it is really hard to stay on Twitter. And the only reason I do it is because I retain that perspective that Twitter is where disabled people were able to get their voice. Twitter is where abused people were able to express their trauma. Twitter is where marginalized racial groups were able to create entire spaces of safety for themselves.
Yes.
And I just keep thinking about, what am I leaving them if I leave? Like, I know what most of the people on Twitter are doing, and I just don't want to do that yet. I don't want to sound heroic. I mean, I'm logging on and I'm typing messages from the safety of my home, but it is a really negative experience. I hate it. I find it a necessary evil because it's where people still are. Mm-hmm. You know, I'll put out a thread just a week ago about suicides in Canada, and it was seen by about 600,000 people. Where else can I do that in my life? Absolutely. You know, I could publish in a journal and it wouldn't be seen by 600,000 people.
Yeah. Might be seen by 60.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, I still believe in scientific publishing for the, you know, posterity's sake, but I still recognize that it's necessary for me to get that message out, especially when I'm battling misinformation. But I really long for the day. I don't know if it's maybe Twitter implodes under Elon Musk's awful leadership, or government regulators step in and say, you have to run social media spaces with more integrity than this. But we have to get the death threats and the racism, yes, and the, you know, all the stuff off of Twitter, and they're doing a really poor job of it.
They really are.
I don't know if, I mean, if anyone listening wants to know, just find me on Twitter. I'm at TylerBlack32. Find any tweet of mine about vaccines and just see all the replies I've hidden.
Oh yeah.
I carefully curate most of my tweets. I go through most of my viral tweets and hide the replies that I don't want my followers to see. Mm-hmm. And people go, "Oh, you're censoring me. I'm like, "No, I'm controlling my Twitter page. That's if right. You want to tweet to your 10 followers, you do that, but you're on my space right
That's
now.
Right.
And I'm going to do what I can to limit your scope."
Yeah.
But the things that I hide, sometimes it's just someone posting an anti-vax meme. And I hide those, even though I don't think they have influence much. I just don't want them on my page.
Right.
But often it's things like conspiracies about Jewish people, or it's you're going to die, or you believe in mutilating children's genitals and you support trans kids. And like, yeah. I can't have that on my page.
Yeah.
And that's, unfortunately, every time I do a thread that goes viral, that's my reward. My reward is streams of hate constantly.
Yeah.
And the way Twitter works is it filters out some of it for you. But when I get a notification, when I look at my Twitter notifications and it's like, "Hi," I know that I'm going to be reading hate.
Yes.
And I dutifully go through all of it to remove the stuff that's egregious. I want to remove racist stuff, anti-trans stuff.
And that's so hard that on you because you have to see it.
It sucks. And I'm the type of person that I want to fight back. So if someone says, you know, someone just kind of posts without any thought, "Oh yeah, your data is invalid," I really feel like proving that it's valid.
Yes.
But of course, what a colossal waste of my time that would be. They're not going to be convinced.
Oh yeah. 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 So I keep trying to remind myself of that. I wield your thread, you know, I go to my bookmarks and I find that thread and I post it underneath it and I walk away and let you worry about the notifications later.
Like I say, I never want to make it sound like I'm going, you know, I'm doing anything really substantial, but it is really hard. Like, yes, you can see it. Anyone who's on Twitter long enough can see it is a negative space. I think it would be in everyone's self-interest to not be on Twitter. And I can't wait for the day that Twitter dies and we find a space that's safer,
or Twitter becomes more improves. Safe. Exactly.
Yeah. Twitter becomes more safe.
I have found a lot of luck, I think, with, switching it from everyone can reply to only my followers or people can reply.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That makes a big difference. You know, you'll still get the quote tweets or whatever, but it's
the good thing about quote tweets is it's up to their followers to see it. Right.
Exactly.
And so when, you know, "Vaccines killed my kid," you know, 83 posts something to their 22 followers, you know, it doesn't have any impact.
Yeah.
But a lot of people do like to coattail on. The only reason I don't do only people who I follow can reply is because I'm such a bad Twitter user. I have so many people that I love to talk to that I don't follow.
Yeah.
I know that if I did that, I'd be turning off some of my favorite people because I've just been negligent. I don't know who all I follow and who I don't. I sometimes remember to hit follow back. But of course I've turned off follow notifications long ago due to the numbers, but, but I'm just a bad follower at this point. So I never want to turn off the voices that I like because there's so many good people on Twitter too.
That's the thing. I, you know, like you say, I would miss Twitter simply because I've made connections like this, right? And you know,
I just love how we've decided to never call it X.
Yeah. I mean, come on. Sometimes I'll call it Exeter.
Exeter. Yes. You could add the Chinese pronunciation.
That's right.
It becomes
right.
A vulgar word.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Tyler, I could speak to you for another hour. You know, maybe someday I will. And
oh, thanks so much.
It
was a pleasure.
You know, great opportunity to finally get to meet you. And this is one of those, you know, podcasts where, you know, I will be not only listening to it again, I'll be making my supervisees listen to this. It's a valuable one, right? It's super helpful.
They can skip the Twitter parts. If there's something I can plug, if people go to my Twitter account at TylerBlack32, my pinned tweet is a series of videos that I worked on last year with a number of youth with lived experience and a family member with lived experience with suicide and self-harm. And it's probably one of the most important things that I've tried to do, which is really get really good person-driven, like experience-driven content out there for parents and caregivers for their kids. Because parents, unfortunately, often their first response to a crisis of suicidality is upset and anger. And it's driven by fear, and I get that. And so the whole idea here is, the more Canadian parents could watch these videos, and they're published by healthyminds.gov.bc.ca. So you'll see the link on my Twitter profile, on my pinned tweet. But if every parent in Canada were to watch those videos, even just the youth videos that are 4 or 5 minutes each, not my long didactic one that's like 36, they would have more than enough information to be ready for that unfortunate but common circumstance in which a youth tells their parent, I've been thinking about dying, or a parent discovers that the child has been self-harming, which is 1 in 6 youth in Canada.
Yes.
And make sure that first parent response is a good one, because it really goes a long way to making that child feel heard and safe versus scared and punished.
That is brilliant. That is brilliant. Yeah. And, you know, thank you for that. And I'm hearing the parallels with coming out, you know, as gay or trans or whatever, right?
Yeah.
The same process. It really is. You know, these are moments when, you know, people need support the most.
Yeah. Parents who are blindsided by things they haven't thought about before, haven't imagined before, they don't respond with their best effort. And they'll even, you know, even in situations where the response is negative, it's often, I shouldn't have said that, but I didn't know what else to say.
Right.
You know, and I'll talk to these parents, and they're loving parents and they care. But they just, you know, they went the security route. You know, you're never going to cut yourself again. Great way to tell your kid that I don't want you to ever feel better. Because again, you know, if you understand what non-suicidal self-harm is, it's an attempt by the child to feel better.
Exactly.
So like I say, if anyone wants to just go to my Twitter profile, TylerBlack32, I'm not asking for people to follow me. I recommend that's the only time you ever log on to Twitter. And then go to that link, on my pinned tweet. There's a series of videos of there. If you know a parent, if you are a parent, if you're someone who works with parents, you will really benefit from those videos.
I'm going to watch those videos because I have not done that yet. So thank you for that.
The first two are long ones by me. There's shorter ones by the youth that are just incredible. I'm so proud of them.
Wonderful. Yeah. Wonderful. Well, thank you for that. And thank you for this.
Thanks for your time.
Hey there. This is Katie from Jane. Thanks for letting our team be a part of your listening experience over these past few months. We're proud to be sponsors of the Ontario Psychological Association and the OnPsych podcast. If you're new to Jane, let me tell you a bit about us. Jane is complete practice management software that can help you navigate your day-to-day with ease and flexibility. This means simple scheduling, streamlined billing, intuitive charting, and so much more. We'd love to meet you and hear your story. Our team is only a phone call or email away, and you can find us over at jane.app/mental health. We look forward to hearing from you.
You have been listening to On Psych, presented by the Ontario Psychological Association. Be sure to subscribe wherever you find your podcasts.